China never really reveals its cards until the end, and Trump has made it clear that he will be the one that's just going to decide, and he's given them no real incentive.
Trade talks with China may or may not be going well. It's Monday, February 18th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a mountainous runoff of water threatens Asia. An arrest shakes journalists in the Philippines. Poaching an endangered anteater. A space mission ends. The politics of climate. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump is hailing progress in ongoing trade talks with China, with negotiators set to meet this week in Washington as the March 1st deadline approaches.
It's going extremely well. Who knows what that means, because it only matters if we get it done, but we're very much working very closely with China and President Xi, who I respect a lot. Very good relationship that we have. And we're a lot closer than we ever were in this country with having a real trade deal.
However, the U.S. president seemed to walk back a bit when he told reporters it's going to be better than any deal that anybody ever dreamed possible, or I'm not going to have a deal. So, which is it? Is there progress or is there not? That's what VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Jeff Moon. Moon is a China trade consultant and former assistant U.S. trade representative for China in the administration of former President Barack Obama.
I think there's been incremental movement, but the way the talks have been set up, with Trump saying that he's not going to decide until the end, that the Chinese are holding all the real cards until the end of the negotiation, and that they won't budge very much. By all outside accounts, the Chinese are willing to make progress on the market, some of the market access issues. That includes purchases of things like soybeans and energy products, and perhaps opening some sectors like the financial sector is what's most frequently mentioned. But they are not addressing the real core underlying issues in the dispute, which is China's industrial policy, which leads to IPR theft and a variety of other abuses. China never really reveals its cards until the end, and Trump has made it clear that he will be the one that's just going to decide, and he's given them no real incentive to bring their cards to the table until he and she meet.
Well, he, meaning Trump, has already said he might very well extend the deadline for increased tariffs to go into effect. Is that not something being offered to the Chinese?
Not at this point. I think that they're going to wait until March the 1st to decide that. I don't think there'll be a real signal on that until the very last minute. I think that that is the most likely scenario, however, and I hope that that's what happens, because in fact, if they're going to address the industrial policy issues, it's not possible to resolve those issues in 2 weeks. Those are very complex issues that require longer talks. So from the perspective of the core American issues, a quick settlement is not a good settlement. It just glosses things over. And frankly, if the trade dispute wraps up without industrial policy issues being addressed, then that just carries those issues over beyond the current tariff dispute. And that's going to get very messy and very aggressive as that plays out over the longer term. It's much better for the negotiators to work out an orderly resolution of those issues than to leave them hanging over, and then we're going to get into an unpredictable, messy phase where all sorts of uncoordinated retaliation comes as a result of inability to address those problems.
Where do you think China stands on this?
I think China's hoping to, one, wait Trump out. They're buying for time. They're hoping they'll wait out, as much of his term as they can. I think they're hoping that perhaps also with time, the economics in both of the markets will lead Trump to perhaps come to a deal that's easier rather than harder. And I think that they are extremely resistant to change what they see as their socialist economic system. The problem is that China, one, was supposed to morph from a state-led economy into a market-led economy as a part of its WTO accession. And it just hasn't done that. And second, when China came into the WTO, it was very much a developing country. It is now very much a developed country, the second largest economy in the world. And it got breaks when it came in that it no longer deserves. It should not be able to close off large sectors of its economy to foreign competition like it did when it needed a leg up in the world economy. So we need to marketize or bring market principles into the equation, and China needs to finally open up its market.
How much of this is economics and how much of this is politics on either side?
I think it's mostly about economics. I think that unfortunately, Trump has allowed a lot of politics to enter into this. In previous administrations, trade was on its own lane. It did not intersect with things like North Korea or other issues. And what has happened is that Trump has allowed other issues to enter into the equation, some of them political. And that has sort of muddied the negotiations and made it difficult to sort out what can be done and how to move forward in an orderly way. And that's very problematic. We really should get back to having trade issues be trade issues and other issues be separated out, because there is no major problem in this world where the United States and China don't need to talk to each other. And separating those issues out separately allows us to deal with them more effectively.
So did I just hear optimism or pessimism?
Neither, really. I just think the realistic approach is that the deadline gets extended and probably goes into late this year, the negotiations, I would suspect.
Jeff Moon, former assistant trade representative for China in the Obama administration. The reported goal for negotiators this week is to reach a memorandum of understanding before the March 1st tariff increase deadline. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. China rebuffs Germany's call for U.S. missile deal with Russia. Arrest of journalist Maria Ressa casts pall on Philippines' journalistic independence. Kim Jong-un to arrive in Vietnam February 25th ahead of Trump summit. A researcher says China's surveillance firm is tracking millions in Xinjiang. Huge land loss predicted for Vietnam's Mekong Delta. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Stop by our voanews.com website as well. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A new report brings some troubling news. Researchers believe the Himalayas contain about 27% less glacial ice than previously thought. We say troubling because melt runoff from the glaciers is a major source of water for large parts of Asia, including China and India. Christopher Scott is director of the Udall Center at the University of Arizona and was co-author of the report.
The Himalayan region, given its high elevation clearly as the roof of the world, but also its important effect in catching monsoon precipitation, that is snowfall and rain in the lower elevations, is and the accumulation of ice that results from that is the third largest accumulation of ice outside of the two poles, the North Pole and the South Pole. So it's referred to as the third pole, and there are vast volumes of ice stored in Himalayan glacier and snow that is a phenomenon that melts more annually. The Himalayan region is the home or the source of water for 10 large river systems that cumulatively represent a downstream population of 2 billion people. We're talking particularly about the Ganges with 580 million people, the Yangtze with 605 million people. Together there, you've got close to 1.3 million people.
So there is a new study out that suggests that there might be around 27% less glacial ice in the Himalayas than was previously estimated. 27% sounds like a fairly large number, but what do you think that, if in fact it bears out, what would that mean for regions in Asia?
Yeah, the study that you're referring to is called the Hindu Kush Himalaya Monitoring and Assessment Program, or HIMAP, that was a collaborative effort led by the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development, or ISIMOD, based in Kathmandu, Nepal. Many of us participated in the process. I was the coordinating lead author together with two colleagues for the water resources chapter. The actual impact on glacial volumes and glacial melt that you talked about was another chapter that, of course, is central to the way we did our analysis, but that showed that very significant volumes of ice stored in the high mountain Himalayan third pole region that I referred to are undergoing rapid melt processes. And so both changes in estimates of the amount of ice stored, but also the future projection of very dramatic melting.
Is there any sense among researchers such as yourself that this process may be a momentary, you know, blip, or is it part of a larger pattern, do you think? Because, you know, we keep, not to mix things up here, but we keep hearing stories about much more rapid ice, glacial ice melting in, say, Greenland or Antarctica than had previously been calculated.
This is not a momentary blip. This is a real, and the use of the word watershed moment is very apt here. Watershed moment in that sense being it's a real threshold. It's a crossing point. We're into a new operating reality. We're into a new climate regime, and that is with global warming having a pronounced effect at higher elevations. In other words, higher elevations in the Himalayas are warming on a year-by-year basis more quickly than lowland regions, and this has a pronounced impact on ice melt. The reason it's not a momentary blip is once the vast volumes of glacier ice are significantly melted, there is less future ice stored for melting, which means we will have significantly less water in the river system, and including with the timing that I referred to earlier, which is your first question, than we had in the past.
Professor Christopher Scott of the University of Arizona speaking with VOA Asia's Doug Bernard. Happening now in Asia, Australia's centre-right government says it will reopen a controversial detention centre on Christmas Island after Parliament voted to allow asylum seekers on Nauru and Manus to come to Australia for medical treatment. Passage of the bill was an embarrassing defeat for Prime Minister Scott Morrison. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us as we start out a brand new week on VOA Asia. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the Philippine judiciary to drop all charges against journalist Maria Ressa. It says pursuing the case threatens an independent media in the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
Maria Ressa, founder and CEO of the independent news outlet Ruppler, was arrested on libel charges earlier this week. She has since been freed on bail. This is not her first arrest. Ressa, a frequent critic of the policies of Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, has repeatedly been charged with infractions such as tax evasion. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says Ressa was charged in an effort to prevent the independent voice of Ruppler from being heard. He tells VOA she is being charged with libel or defamation under the Philippines 2012 Cybercrime Prevention Act.
It makes online libel a crime punishable for up to 12 years in jail, so it's a pretty draconian sentence. In views of international human rights experts, defamation law should not lead to criminal charges, and in this case, this law is being used to censor, silence, and threaten journalists.
Colville says the Ressa case is likely to have repercussions on other journalists, pushing many to self-censorship for fear of being punished. He says the public could be deprived of good news reporting as a result. The UN Human Rights Office is calling for a thorough, independent review of all charges against Ressa and other media professionals in the Philippines. It urges the judiciary to safeguard its own independence by throwing out cases that clearly are politically motivated. It says the charges are not in line with international human rights standards. It adds they also trample on the rights of journalists to carry out their professional duties safely and without fear of reprisal. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, protecting an elusive anteater. You're listening to VOA Asia. The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. News from VOA Asia, China is promising about $3.5 billion to help bolster Pakistan's dwindling foreign cash reserves and pay for socioeconomic development plans undertaken by the country's new government. Beijing will soon deposit $2.5 billion to raise to $4.5 billion, the total amount in commercial loans China has given Pakistan this fiscal year. You'll find a wealth of stories at VOA Asia Facebook. As VOA Asia continues, Sunday was World Pangolin Day, a day wildlife advocates have said meant to bring awareness about the plight of the pangolin. A group called WildAid says there have recently been multiple massive seizures of pangolin scales in Asia and Africa, highlighting an urgent poaching crisis that threatens the species' survival. Peter Knights, CEO of WildAid, tells VOA's Laurie London about these little-known animals.
Not many people have heard of pangolins, and it may be that they even disappeared before many people even know what they are, but they are actually small, scaly anteaters, and they eat ants and termites, and they live in both Africa and Asia. There's eight species altogether, and now they're all classified as endangered. Pangolins are very elusive. They're very hard to see. Most people haven't seen any of them. Even people that live out in the wilds in Africa and are guides and things may never have seen a pangolin because they're nocturnal and very shy. And yet somehow these traders are managing to get shipments that have tons at a time, representing, in some cases, tens of thousands of pangolins in one seizure. They are, in fact, the world's most trafficked mammal. So it's been very depressing to see that. But the other trend we've been noticing recently is the ivory traders, the people smuggling ivory internationally, again, mainly to China and Vietnam, have now started mixing pangolin scales and ivory into the same shipments. And so those three shipments you were referring to were all mixed shipments of both ivory and pangolin scales.
They've also recently received upgraded international level of protection with what has been happening. How much could that help the situation or decrease the poaching?
I think one of the reasons why these shipments of ivory are now mixed in with pangolin scales is China has banned all sales of ivory, and that's reduced and helped to reduce the price of ivory about two-thirds. But there is a big loophole in the law right now, and that's in China, where sales of pangolin scales within China are still legal. So if you can smuggle pangolin scales into China, you have the possibility of then legally selling them, as that trade isn't regulated right now. So President Xi did that bold step of banning ivory, which has certainly had a major impact on reducing ivory smuggling, and we're hoping that China could also do the same with pangolin scales and stop that domestic market, and that will help stop the international demand for pangolin scales.
Are they at risk at this point of extinction?
Certainly in Asia, the pangolins are very endangered, the Chinese pangolin in particular. Very, very few left. We know very little about the populations of pangolin because they are so elusive. They are often nocturnal. They only have one baby at a time. So we know very little about them other than these huge numbers have been showing up in trade, and they're becoming scarcer and scarcer to find in the wild. So the Chinese pangolin in particular could be on the verge of extinction at this point.
On this World Pangolin Day, obviously you want to raise awareness about the plight of the pangolin. If you had to sum up what your message would be regarding this issue, what would it be?
Obviously, in Asia, it's China and Vietnam in particular. Please do not consume pangolin scales or meat. In fact, for the scales, there are over 100 alternatives in traditional medicine, so there's no need to have them in traditional medicine. And then for the rest of the world, we need to help support pangolin conservation and pangolin protection.
Peter Knight, CEO of WildAid, speaking with VOA's Laurie London. This news from VOA Asia, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will arrive in Vietnam February 25th ahead of a planned second summit with U.S. President Donald Trump. Trump and Kim are due to meet in Hanoi February 27th and 28th, following their historic first meeting last June in Singapore. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the Mars Opportunity rover landed on the red planet's surface back in 2004 for just a 90-day mission of exploration. More than 14 years later, NASA has finally closed the book on this tiny rover that wandered across Mars, sending back troves of information. We have more from VOA's Kevin Enix.
And liftoff.
No one at NASA would have ever hoped that the Martian rover Opportunity on board this Delta rocket launched in 2004 for a three-month mission would end up trundling across the Martian surface for more than a decade.
You know, this was a 90-day mission, and we were so excited by just having 3 months to explore the planet with just a kilometer of capability. But 14 and a half years later and 45 kilometers of odometry, we've done phenomenal things. We've greatly expanded our understanding of the red planet.
Like finding these blue hematite spheres, proof that Mars once had liquid water on its surface. And it might have gone for another 14 years if not for a run-in with a massive Martian storm.
Well, back in June, we were afflicted by a historic global dust storm on Mars. It just blackened the skies over the rover and starved the rover for energy, and the rover went silent. And we tried valiantly over these last 8 months to try to recover the rover, to get some signal from it.
But no signal came. So after 14 years and a meandering 45-kilometer route across the Martian surface, NASA finally decided Opportunity was gone.
It is therefore that I'm standing here with a sense of deep appreciation and gratitude that I declare the Opportunity mission as complete, and with it, the Mars Exploration Rover mission as complete. I stand here surrounded by the team, and I have to tell you, this is an emotional time.
So long, Opportunity. Gone but not forgotten. Someday, perhaps, if humans ever find their way to Mars, they'll go looking for the little rover that could, and did, for nearly 15 years. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, like the climate on Mars, the climate here is not only changing globally, it's changing in Washington. With Democrats in control of the House of Representatives, climate change is again on the agenda. VOA's Steve Barragona tells us some Democrats are proposing what they call the Green New Deal, an ambitious and controversial program to transform the nation's energy supply.
Just weeks after taking over the House of Representatives, Democrats are talking big about tackling climate change.
Climate change and our environmental challenges are one of the biggest existential threats to our way of life. And in order for us to combat that threat, we must be as ambitious and innovative in our solution as possible.
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey have launched what they call the Green New Deal.
When we talk about a Green New Deal, we are talking about jobs and justice. We are talking about the greatest blue-collar job creation program in a generation.
The program aims to overhaul the entire energy system in 10 years with a massive expansion of renewable energy sources, efficiency programs, and zero-emission vehicles. It would reduce emissions from agriculture and grow carbon-absorbing forests. But the proposal does not say how.
While the resolution does not mention any specific technology, it talks about any technology that can dramatically reduce greenhouse gases. So
the proposal also does not specify how to pay for the programs. It has almost no chance of becoming law under President Donald Trump, who routinely dismisses the threat of climate change on Twitter. Trump called the proposal a massive government takeover. But even within the Democratic Party, some call it unrealistic. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called it the Green Dream. But Ocasio-Cortez doesn't mind.
No, I think it is a green dream. And I think that It is. All great American programs, everything from the Great Society to the New Deal, started with a vision for our future.
That vision will remain in the future as Democrats look to the 2020 elections. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the radio throughout Asia, like Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today. We find in our control room our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Aydin Utku, and our managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day.